Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for May 1, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shy. On the front page, the top story, entitled One for the Record Books, Nebraska and Iowa Hit Friday by Strongest Tornadoes in a Decade. The images of splintered homes and farms leave little doubt about the ferocity of the tornado-spawning storms that battered eastern Nebraska and western Iowa on Friday. But new information released Monday by the National Weather Service's Omaha office in Valley indicates that they were the most powerful storms to hit the area in the past 10 years. In its preliminary assessment, the Omaha office has tallied 10 tornadoes within its coverage area, 5 rated an EF3 on the Enhanced Fujita scale, 2 rated EF2, and 3 listed as EF1. The EF3 tornadoes, which pack winds of 136 miles an hour to 165 miles per hour, are the strongest to strike the area since an EF3 landed near Coleridge on June 17, 2014, according to the report. That storm struck a day after 4 EF4 tornadoes tore through northeast Nebraska, including the twin EF4 twisters that hit Pilger on June 16, 2014. We haven't seen tornadoes this strong in our area for a decade, said Brennan Dara, a meteorologist with the Omaha office. In a press conference, Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen said the state does not have preliminary damage figures yet, but some 500 homes have been damaged or destroyed, including a number of high-value properties. Pillen also estimated that 4 hangars that were destroyed at Omaha's Epley Airfield will cost $1.5 million each to replace. Restoring electricity and fixing damage to electrical infrastructure will likely top $6 million. Other costs include clearing roadways of debris. Law enforcement officials have been providing security in damaged neighborhoods. To help assess damage, officials said the Federal Emergency Management Agency has contracted for Civil Air Patrol to conduct imaging flights over the tornado path. Nebraska Emergency Management Agency Assistant Director Irv Portis said it will take several days before all data is fully collected. 14 tornadoes tallied across the region so far. Number will certainly go up. In its assessment of the storm's power, the Weather Service said crews have surveyed all of the stronger tornadoes that struck the region, but Dara said the agency is still working to assess smaller ones. The total number of tornadoes will certainly go up, said Dara, who called the event one for the record books. The Weather Service office in Hastings tallied 5 tornadoes Friday across south-central Nebraska in Buffalo, Sherman, Howard, and Greeley counties. Because of some overlap in storms, one of those tornadoes also was included in the Omaha office's total. Together, the two offices so far have counted 14 tornadoes for the night. Additional tornadoes were recorded in central Iowa and Missouri, Dara said. The tornadoes the Omaha office surveyed combined for a total track length of 162.5 miles and were on the ground for a total of 4 hours and 51 minutes, according to the Omaha office's report. The maximum wind speed based on ground-level damage assessments was 165 miles per hour. The maximum single tornado track length was 40.9 miles. 2 tornadoes were up to a mile wide at some point. The tornadoes were spawned by storms known as supercells, which go through cycles. They can strengthen and spin out a tornado, then weaken, and later form again to produce more, Dara said. One supercell tracked from Wilbur through northeast Lincoln and the Waverly area, where it produced one EF3 tornado that struck the Garner Industries plant at 98th Street and U.S. Highway 6, where 70 employees were sheltered. It collapsed the roof of the plant and three walls. The storm moved north and east, then produced a separate EF3 tornado in western Douglas County that tracked through the western part of Elkhorn, striking the Ramblewood Division, subdivision, and other neighborhoods before moving on to Bennington's Newport Landing neighborhood. The tornado, which fluctuated in strength, then passed south of Blair, damaging more homes. It moved across the southern portion of the Cargill plant in Blair before crossing the Missouri River into Iowa, a path of 31 miles. A separate storm produced an EF3 tornado that developed just east of the Epley Airfield runway, destroying several aircraft hangars and aircraft, and then crossed the river and damaged homes south of Crescent. It continued northeast and dissipated in a field just north of the Harrison-Pottawatomie County line. A third storm produced two EF3 tornadoes, one that started in southwest Iowa and came within a mile or two of McClelland, and another that struck Minden before tracking as far as Harlan and Defiance, cutting a path nearly 41 miles long. At the National Weather Service, the meteorologist wrote, "Our hearts are with all of those impacted, including our friends, our neighbors, and everyone who has been affected by these devastating tornadoes." Pillen urged Nebraskans to report damage from Friday's storms to local emergency management agencies, even if they have been able to handle the aftermath themselves. "It's really important to get the message out. If you don't ask for help, we actually harm our neighbors," he said. Pillen said such reporting will help Nebraska take advantage of all the federal assistance possible in the wake of the tornado outbreak. He said emergency management officials are tracking and documenting damage as part of the state's request for federal disaster assistance to help with recovery. Over the weekend, the governor toured the Elkhorn and Bennington areas in Douglas County and the parts of Washington County that were hit hardest by tornadoes. He described the scenes of damage as, quote, devastating, close quote, and, quote, extraordinarily sobering, close quote, with trees ripped out of the ground and former houses turned into nothing but concrete. "It's going to be years before the scars are healed," Pillen said, adding that it was only by God's grace that no one in Nebraska suffered severe injuries in Nebraska. One man in Minden, Iowa, died of injuries sustained in the storm. Pillen has issued emergency declarations for Washington, Lancaster, and Douglas counties. Other counties reporting varying degrees of storm damage include Boone, Buffalo, Butler, Greeley, Howard, Nance, Platt, Saunders, and Sherman. It is possible that additional emergency declarations will be issued in the coming days, depending on the level of damage reported in those counties. Information for tornado recovery efforts in Omaha can be found on the city's homepage website. The city created a new section for its homepage on Saturday, according to a spokesman for Mayor Gene Stoth. Emergency information will be featured prominently at the website, she said. The Douglas County Health Department issued a press release Monday to remind people whose homes are supplied by wells that Friday's storm may have left them with some specific issues. "If you live in one of those homes, you need to make sure debris did not damage your wellhead before you use the water from that well," the press release said. "A damaged or even cracked wellhead can be a point for contamination from rain. If your wellhead is damaged, it should be inspected and repaired by a qualified well repair service." The health department also advised residents to check all house power supply lines for damage before reconnecting them to a home. The well pump can be turned off at the breaker if the power needs to be used if the well or house supply lines are compromised. If flooding occurred over the wellhead, your home water should be tested before it is consumed. If flooding has occurred around the septic tank system, please give a day or two for the ground to recover before using a lot of water in the home, the statement said. Debris can become a place for disease-carrying vermin. Dispose of all debris as soon as possible without letting it pile up for long periods of time. Anyone with questions is asked to call the Douglas County Health Department sanitation line at 402-444-7481. Also on the front page, an article entitled Iowa Advocates Expect Push for Pesticide Tort Protections. A proposal to prohibit lawsuits over warning labels on pesticides, if the product already has a qualifying warning label, sparked a debate this year at the Iowa Capitol about the role of pesticides in crop production on the state's economy and on the public health of Iowa farmers. The proposed legislation ultimately failed to gain sufficient support among Iowa lawmakers to pass into law this year. The topic is likely to return to the legislative agenda in 2025. The bill was proposed by the pesticide manufacturer Bayer, which has multiple crop science plants in Iowa. Bayer makes the glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup and has faced lawsuits nationwide from individuals claiming the company failed to warn customers of the potential health risks of the weed killer. Jess Christensen, the head of crop science and sustainability communications for Bayer, said Monday that she hopes to continue the discussion with Iowa lawmakers in 2025. She said the resources Bayer must devote to defending Roundup from lawsuits is not sustainable for the company. It's not a sustainable business model for us, so we are looking at various strategies to figure out how do we really keep important tools such as Roundup on the market for farmers, Christensen said. We really want to do everything we possibly can to make sure that there's access to these tools for farmers. So we're going to continue, and that's one of the reasons we want to continue the dialogue. The legislative proposal, Senate File 2412, passed the Iowa Senate on a 30-19 vote that was mostly party line, with only Republicans supporting and four Republicans joining all Democrats in voting against. The proposal did not receive any legislation attention in the Iowa House. Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley, a Republican from New Hartford, said recently on Iowa PBS Iowa Press that the debate over the bill was difficult. It was a very difficult issue trying to decide where to land on that, Grassley said on Iowa Press. Grassley went on to express concern about how the lawsuits are impacting Bayer and its facilities in Iowa. I think you've seen some of the impacts it has had on Bayer as a company. We have to realize it is having an impact. And the largest facility they have in the creation of Roundup is in Iowa, Grassley said. So the question gets back to me is where do we want to source our things within agriculture? It could be Roundup, or this herbicide in this instance. It could be something else some other time. I just don't want us to become more dependent on something that's not produced here in Iowa or in America and have to look to other countries, maybe even some that are unfriendly, that produce these products. Roundup has received significant scrutiny over health claims and its link to the development of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. About 165,000 cancer claims have been brought in the United States against Bayer over exposure to the weed killer, according to reporting by Reuters. Many were resolved as part of a $9.6 billion settlement in 2020, but about 54,000 remain. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found that glyphosate, quote, is unlikely to be a human carcinogen, close quote, and that there are no risks of concern to human health when used in accordance with its current label. However, a U.S. appeals court ordered the agency to reconsider those findings in 2022. A World Health Organization cancer agency in 2015 found glyphosate was likely capable of causing cancer, but European Union regulators have determined there was not sufficient evidence for that finding. Iowa has the fastest growing rate of new cancers in the nation and the second highest cancer rate overall. Physicians and public health professionals have said it's time to look more closely at how Iowa's agriculture might be contributing. Opponents of the proposed legislation expressed concern that it would strip Iowans of a legal avenue to challenge pesticide manufacturers over adverse health effects caused by prolonged exposure to pesticides. Critics contended that such a bill could leave Iowa farmers without legal recourse. Supporters of the bill argued that it is limited in scope, that it would prohibit only lawsuits over labeling once a product meets labeling requirements from federal regulators. The Iowa Farm Bureau, Iowa Corn Producers, Corn Growers Association, and the Iowa Association of Business and Industry are among the Iowa groups that registered in support of the bill, according to state lobbying records. A multi-state coalition of agricultural groups that supports legal protection for glyphosate also includes the Iowa Soybean Association. The Gazette was unable to obtain a comment on the legislation from the Iowa Farm Bureau or the Iowa Corn Growers Association, who deferred to Bayer. The groups who lobbied against the proposal this year include organizations that represent attorneys and environmental groups. Similar legislative proposals have been introduced in Missouri and Idaho. On page 2, we find an article entitled "Powerball Win Puts Spotlight on an Immigrant Culture." Cheng Charlie Saifan wore a broad smile and a bright blue sash emblazoned with the words "Lumien USA," "Iumien USA," as he hosted an oversized check for $1.3 billion above his head. The 46-year-old immigrant's luck in winning an enormous Powerball jackpot in Oregon, a lump sum payment of $422 million after taxes, which he and his wife will split with a friend, changed his life. It also raised awareness about Iumien people, a Southeast Asian ethnic group with origins in China, many of whose members fled from Laos to Thailand and then settled in the U.S. after the Vietnam War. "I am born in Laos, but I am not Laotian," Saifan told a news conference Monday in Oregon Lottery headquarters, where his identity as one of the jackpot's winners was revealed. "I am Iumien." During the Vietnam War, the CIA and U.S. military recruited Iumien in neighboring Laos, many of them subsistence farmers, to engage in guerrilla warfare and to provide intelligence and surveillance to disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail that the North Vietnamese used to send troops and weapons through Laos and Cambodia into South Vietnam. After the conflict, as well as the Laotian Civil War, when the U.S.-backed government of Laos fell in 1975, they fled by the thousands to avoid reprisals from the new communist government, escaping by foot through the jungle and then across the Mekong River into Dai Land, according to a history posted on the website of Iumien Community Services in Sacramento, California. More than 70% of the Iumien population in Laos left, and many wound up in refugee camps in Thailand. Thousands of the refugees were allowed to come to the U.S., with the first waves arriving in the late 1970s and most settling along the West Coast. The culture had rich traditions of storytelling, basketry, embroidery, and jewelry making, but many initially had difficulty adjusting to Western life due to cultural and language differences, as well as a lack of formal education. There are now tens of thousands of Iumien, pronounced Iumien, in the U.S., with many attending universities or starting businesses. Many converted to Christianity from traditional animist religions. There is a sizable Yumien community in Portland and its suburbs, with a Buddhist temple and Baptist church, active social organization, and businesses and restaurants. Cale Turn, president of the Yumien Association of Oregon, arrived in Portland with his family in 1980 when he was 3 years old. He is now running for city council. Saifan's Powerball win is significant for other Yumien, he said. It means so much because all of us came with so little, Turn said. I take pride in seeing our members of the community advance and flourish, and I just feel so good for him. Saifan, 46, said he was born in Laos and moved to Thailand in 1987 before immigrating to the U.S. in 1994. He graduated from high school in 1996 and has lived in Portland for 30 years. He worked as a machinist for an aerospace company. He said Monday that he has had cancer for 8 years and had his latest chemotherapy treatment last week. I will be able to provide for my family and my health, he said, adding that he'd find a good doctor for myself. Saifan, who has two young children, said that as a cancer patient, he wondered, how am I going to have time to spend all of this money? How long will I live? He said he and his 37-year-old wife, Duan Pen, are taking half the money, and the rest is going to a friend, Liza Chow, 55, of the Portland suburb of Milwaukee. Chow had chipped in $100 to buy a batch of tickets with them. Chow was on her way to work when Saifan called her with the news. You don't have to go anymore, he said. In the weeks leading up to the drawing, he wrote out numbers for the game on a piece of paper and slept with it under his pillow, he said. He prayed that he would win, saying, I need some help. I don't want to die yet unless I have done something for my family first. The winning Powerball ticket was sold in early April at a Plaid Pantry convenience store in Portland, ending a winless streak that stretched more than 3 months. The Oregon Lottery said it had to go through a security and vetting process before announcing the identity of the person who came forward to claim the prize. Under Oregon law, with few exceptions, lottery players cannot remain anonymous. Winners have a year to claim the top prize. In national and world news, the lead article relates to the Trump hush money criminal trial. And the headline is, Judge Threatens Jail Time. Court holds former president in contempt for violating the gag order. Donald Trump was held in contempt of court Tuesday and fined $9,000 for repeatedly violating a gag order that barred him from making public statements about witnesses, jurors, and some others connected to his New York hush money case. If he does it again, the judge warned, he could be jailed. Prosecutors alleged 10 violations, but New York Judge Juan Merchan found there were 9. It was a stinging rebuke of the Republican former president's insistence that he was exercising his free speech rights and a reminder that he's a criminal defendant subject to the harsh realities of trial procedure. This gag order is totally unconstitutional, Trump said as court adjourned. Merchan wrote that he is keenly aware of and protective of Trump's First Amendment rights, particularly given his candidacy for the office of President of the United States. Still, he warned that the court would not tolerate willful violations of its lawful orders, and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment. Tuesday's ruling came at the start of the second week of testimony in the historic case, in which Manhattan prosecutors argued Trump and his associates took part in an illegal scheme to influence the 2016 presidential campaign by purchasing and then burying Seamy Stories. The payouts went to a doorman with a torrid yarn, ex-Playboy model Karen McDougal, who had accusations of an affair, and to porn performer Stormy Daniels, who alleged a sexual encounter with Trump. He pleaded not guilty and says the stories are all fake. The judge also announced he will halt the trial on May 17 to allow Trump to attend his son Barron's high school graduation. In other developments, testimony resumed Tuesday with Gary Faro, a banker who helped former Trump attorney Michael Cohen open accounts, including one that Cohen used to buy Daniel's silence. Jurors also began hearing from Keith Davidson, a lawyer who represented McDougal and Daniels in their negotiations with the National Enquirer and Cohen. He testified that he arranged a meeting at his Los Angeles office to see whether the tabloid's parent company was interested in McDougal's story. The tabloid eventually bought the story. Even as the deal was signed, Davidson testified that he understood McDougal's story would never be published. And now a story about campus demonstration. Headlined, Students Occupy School Building. Columbia authorizes police to enter grounds and end protest at hall. Police took protesters into custody late Tuesday after Columbia University called in police to end the pro-Palestinian occupation on the New York campus. The scene unfolded shortly after 9 p.m. as officers wearing helmets and carrying zip ties and riot shields massed at the Ivy League University's entrance. Officers breached Hamilton Hall, an administration building on campus, to clear out the structure. The demonstrators had occupied the building more than 12 hours earlier, spreading their reach from an encampment elsewhere on the grounds that's been there for nearly 2 weeks. Students defiantly set up tents again after police cleared an encampment at the university on April 18 and arrested more than 100 people. The students were protesting on the Manhattan campus since the prior day, opposing Israeli military action in Gaza and demanding the school divest from companies they claim are profiting from the conflict. Protests spread to campuses from California to Massachusetts as May commencement ceremonies near, putting added pressure on schools to clear protesters. Other colleges have sought to negotiate agreements with the demonstrators in the hopes of having peaceful commencement ceremonies. On Columbia's campus, protesters locked arms early Tuesday and carried furniture and metal barricades to Hamilton Hall, which was among several buildings that were occupied during a 1968 civil rights and anti-Vietnam War protest. Demonstrators called the building Heinz Hall, honoring a young girl who was killed in Gaza under Israeli fire. Israel and its supporters branded the university protest as anti-Semitic, while Israel's critics say it uses those allegations to silence opposition. Though some protesters were caught on camera making anti-Semitic remarks or violent threats, organizers of the protests, some of whom are Jewish, say it is a peaceful movement aimed at defending Palestinian rights and protesting the war. Meanwhile, House Republicans on Tuesday announced an investigation into federal funding for universities where students protested. Several House committees will be tasked with a probe that threatens to withhold government support to the... And that does it for today's reading of the Globe Gazette for May 1, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. And now, welcome to the reading of the Messenger for May 1, 2024. On the front page, the main article is entitled Into Ukraine, an unplanned shortcut leads to an interesting journey for this writer and his entourage. Dad, do you want to take a load of food up into Ukraine? Tim asked one morning. Tim had always turned down requests to drive or ride along on food and supply deliveries into Ukraine. Being a family man with younger children, he felt forays into even safe areas of Ukraine was not worth the risk. But this time, when fellow missionary David McGuire called, needing another driver for a run up to Chernivtsi, Ukraine, he told him, "My dad is here. Let me see if he wants to go. If he does, we will." In spite of protests from his mother, Tim and I, on a Friday morning, headed to a small village just a few kilometers outside of Sigosara, to where McGuire and his wife live. For 28 years, McGuire has been working for the Lord in Romania, and mostly in and around Sigisoara. His missionary efforts were made possible, and still are, by supporters from his native England. Prior to the start of the war, he was engaged in building small homes for the Roma people in the villages around Sigisoara. The Roma, also known by the more derogatory name Gypsy, for the most part no longer roam from one village or country to another. Still generally very poor, they tend to live in camps on the edges of cities and in the smaller villages throughout the countryside. Prior to Romania being accepted into the European Union, the Roma were simply non-existent in the eyes of the federal, state, and local government. In the years under communism and Soviet Russia's control, the Roma were ignored. Life has gotten better for them in recent years, but there is still a long way to go. It is mostly missionaries from around the world that are moving the needle on the life condition for these folks. When we got to the village of Danes and turned into McGuire Street, there was a large red Toyota van with an enclosed trailer hooked on behind and a blue van with tulips painted on the sides. Neither vehicle was close to new. The blue van had been aptly nicknamed the Scooby-Doo van, I would learn by previous volunteer crews. It must have belonged to a floral shop in a previous life. Tim and I would be driving Scooby-Doo. Both vans and the trailer had magnetic signs on them indicating in multiple languages that these were humanitarian aid vehicles. On the way out of Danes, we smelled something hot on Tim's vehicle, a Renault Kangoo. The vast array of European and Asian brands and models of vehicles in Romania, and probably throughout Eastern Europe, is so interesting. Tim was under the Kangoo, checking out the emergency brake cable, when David, his wife Rodica, and another volunteer, Christy, drove up. Christy and I had met before. He is a Roma and one of the hardest working and honest people I have ever met. Tim had hired him to help work on his house when I was there in years past. He hopped out to help Tim analyze the Kangoo. I had never met the 6-foot-plus Englishman from the village of Glossop near Manchester, or his wife, who is Romanian. After quick introductions, David walked over to the Kangoo to add his thoughts on the issues. Rodica told me with a smile, "Autos here always broke, always a problem." I did not know how prophetic her comment would become. She was a teenager during communism, and we had a short but interesting conversation about those times. Tim was pouring water on a rear wheel that sizzled when David said in his thick brogue, "Okay, we need to get going." Christy and Tim thought they had the Kangoo's problem resolved. We loaded our overnight packs, snacks, and drinks into Scooby-Doo for the 12-hour trip to Chumivisti. David came over to Tim's window with a map on his phone, showing Tim a shortcut that he had found. It was a logging road, but this time of year, it should be in good shape. Although I am easily sucked in by shortcuts, I rarely have good luck with them. I didn't say anything. After the shortcut, Christy told Tim and I tried to tell him. David had the vans loaded to the ceiling with boxes of cooking oil, canned meats, rice, the standard fare. I was now used to seeing. There were also a few boxes of a pastry with a chocolate filling. We could snack on these if we wanted, but they were for a special purpose later in the journey. The other van was loaded exactly the same as ours, both loaded with probably twice the weight that they were built to carry. The trailer was loaded with some food boxes too, but was mostly jammed full of used clothing. I wrote down in my notebook that we left Danes about 9:45 a.m. David was driving the other van with Christy riding shotgun. Rodica was staying home. The roads in Romania are narrow, some more narrow than others. A lane and a half is standard on what I would call secondary roads. Primary highways are close to two lanes. In my opinion, with neither secondary or primary having any uniform shoulders, if any, I do have to admit that I did see significant improvement in roads from our last visit in 2021. The bits and pieces of a high-speed railway sprinkled throughout the countryside with the goal of connecting Sighișoara to Western Europe looked the same. Tim believes that the government has chosen to put more money into roads. Our trip north to the western border of Ukraine began uneventfully. We averaged around 55 to 60 miles an hour. With that being the top speed, given how loaded the vans were, we didn't need to worry about passing anyone, except for the random horse and wagon. While they are not allowed on primary highways, you always have to be on the lookout for them on the secondary roads and streets in town. During the time frames before and after school, they will be full of children with an older child driving the horse or horses. Driving through the countryside in mid-March, I was surprised to see many farm fields already being prepared for planting. The weather was gorgeous, and Tim said that this spring was way earlier than normal. David McGuire has been making these trips multiple times a month since the war started. He is always on the hunt for food to run into a variety of locations in Ukraine where the border and oftentimes deeper into the interior. In February, he and Christy had just unloaded at a church in Odessa when a Russian cruise missile came close to taking out Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and the Prime Minister of Greece, who were meeting in the port city. Christy had videos showing the smoke from the explosion. Early on, David would bring back loads of refugees to Sighișoara after making a delivery of food and other supplies. Many just wanted to get out of the fighting and had friends or family elsewhere in Europe to go stay with. Many had nowhere else to go and would stay in Sighișoara. When I interviewed the two teenage girls at the Joy Center, I asked Alona how she and her mother had gotten to Sighișoara from Ukraine. "David brought us," she said. "Do you know David?" She didn't know his last name. The shortcut now lay before us. As we turned off the hard surface primary road onto a dirt road, it started to snow. We were headed to northern Romania into the mountains. The further we drove, the slower we had to go. Worn divots turned into foot-deep holes. David was leading. We had no problem keeping up. The pictures do not do justice to the experience. It was indeed a long, winding road through the mountain pass with massive pines and valleys on both sides. It was beautiful. Tim and I both agreed, but we were just concerned as to how long it was going to last. After an hour and a half, we popped out onto a hard surface. A short way down the road was a town where we stopped for a meal and fuel. I told Christy that I was glad we didn't have a van breakdown while we were on the shortcut. He responded, "No, that is the kind of place that you want to break down. The people who live out there in the middle of nowhere know how to fix most anything with nothing." I was happy to not test his theory that day. We reached the remaining side of the border at 7:15 p.m. It was raining and very dark. We had driven by miles of semi-tractor trailers pulled off to the side of the road, waiting to cross the border. David hopped out of his van and came back to tell us to sit tight. Do not get out. We had all our paperwork organized and ready to present. He walked over to the Romanian border guards with hands full of the chocolate-filled pastries. I don't know if it made a difference, but it was fun to watch him work the guards over with the sweet bribes. We did not spend long on the Romanian side. The Ukrainian side would take a little longer. This story is the third in a series exploring Webster City and Webster City Rotary's connection to Ukraine. As you heard, the writer, Doug Bailey, is working from an intensely personal perspective. Also on the front page, a fun way to fundraise. Dollars for Dodgers underway in Fort Dodge schools. The annual Dollars for Dodgers fundraising event is underway at the Fort Dodge Elementary and Middle School buildings. Previously called Miles of Pennies, the fundraiser encourages students and staff to bring in any loose change or bills to help fund specific projects in each building. Each school building keeps 100% of its funds and will receive a $100 bonus from the Fort Dodge Community Schools Foundation if students and staff reach their goal. This year, the school's foundation moved from Miles of Pennies to Dollars for Dodgers. All proceeds from Dollars for Dodgers go back to those buildings to support different incentives or purchasing items that go above and beyond, said Superintendent Josh Porter. These types of fundraisers are what allow building principals to get a new piece of playground equipment or extra supplies for teachers to have in their classrooms. Each building also offers incentives for students, challenging them to reach their goal. Duncombe School may have the most unique incentive. If Duncombe can reach its goal of raising $1,000, then Principal Ryan Flaherty will spend a night in a tent on the school grounds. Duncombe's goal to raise funds to be used for the implementation of Leader in Me. I did this one other time in Cedar Falls as an incentive for a food drive, and kids and community members enjoyed it, said Duncombe Principal Ryan Flaherty. I just thought it was a free incentive and a way to show everyone in the school that this is important and it is okay to have fun while raising money at school. I wholeheartedly believe in the Leader in Me program, and that is why I am willing to put myself out there a little more to make sure we have the funds to keep this amazing program going, he added. Other awards at Duncombe include hitting a staff member in the face with pie, paint or something else gross, a glow dance party, mystery activities in the gym, pop and popcorn party, or extra recess with the high school helper. Butler's goal is to raise $1,500 for new playground equipment and the Leader in Me program. Their reward for reaching that goal is a park day. Butler also has some smaller incentives for each class, including extra recess, a popsicle party, and ice cream day at Stayburgers, among other things. Cooper's goal is to raise $1,000 for updating and adding recess supplies and equipment. The top three classes will be awarded prizes that include a private concert with Mr. Benson, a class photo booth party, and lunch outside with extra recess. Fieldhaver has a goal of raising $1,000 for updating and adding recess supplies and equipment. Principal Sarah Fitzgerald said a group of student leaders will help determine what to purchase. Students at Fieldhaver will also have the incentive to earn a chance to smash a staff member in the face with a pie, a movie party, or outdoor lunch with extra recess. Students can bring change, bills, or checks to their classroom teachers during the week. We are very appreciative of the support we receive from families as each building creates some fun competitions as they work to bring in dollars to each building, said Porter. Also on the front page, an article entitled Ricky Seeks Change of Venue for Murder Trial. He is charged with killing Algona police officer Cram. The man accused of murdering Algona police officer Kevin Cram last September is asking that his trial be moved out of Kossuth County. Kyle Lou Rickey's first-degree murder trial is scheduled to begin June 25 at the Kossuth County Courthouse in Algona. The trial was originally scheduled for December 12, 2023. In January, it was rescheduled for the June date. His attorney, Matthew Pittenger of Payson City, on Monday filed for the change of venue, according to online court records. Rickey was apprehended near Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, late on September 13, 2023, following a four-hour manhunt after he allegedly shot and killed Cram while the officer was attempting to serve an arrest warrant. Cram, 33, was located by law enforcement and emergency medical services shortly after the shooting and transported to Kossuth Regional Health Center, where he was pronounced dead. Rickey had an active warrant for third-degree harassment, a simple misdemeanor, out of Palo Alto County, court documents show. He had allegedly been harassing a former partner with text messages and phone calls between April and August, according to online court records. After being apprehended in Minnesota, Rickey was extradited back to Kossuth County Jail. He pleaded not guilty to the first-degree murder charge on October 6. He is being represented by the Mason City State Public Defender's Office. Rickey is being held in custody in the Hamilton County Jail. During Rickey's initial appearance in Kossuth County Magistrate Court in September, Prosecutor Scott Brown with the Iowa Attorney General's Office said the shooting was captured at least partially, if not fully, on video. If convicted, Rickey faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. And finally, on the front page, an article entitled Diving into Reading, Iowa Central Students Put Learning into Practice. Students in Jeff Halter's children's literature class at Iowa Central Community College had the opportunity to fully immerse themselves into what they have been studying this semester recently at the Fort Dodge Early Childhood Center. The students visited the school's classrooms in groups and spent the first part of the school day reading to kindergarten classes. Each chose a storybook that they had studied for an earlier project or that they remembered from their own childhoods. Kira Day, an education major, chose Sleepy Sheepy and the Sheepover by Lucy Ruth Cummins to read to students in Shayla Hansen's kindergarten classroom. The book told the story of Sleepy Sheepy, a little sheep who overcomes the fear of sleeping over with her grandparents for the first time. Day chose the book because it reminded her of a younger family member who was nervous about staying with her and being away from their parents. "It's a story I can relate back to a personal experience in my life," said Day. "I love getting to do this kind of thing with kids." The students she read to expressed their thoughts also. "I like sleepovers," one kindergartner said, while another was quick to share, "I get to have a sleepover in 4 days." Ella Jensen read Brenda Lee's The Girl Who Makes a Million Mistakes, which shared a lesson in resilience and life esteem. It's about a girl named Millie who overcomes challenges as she learns and practices, Jensen said. "It has a good lesson." Kongolo Mankambi read Mama, If You Had a Wish, to his group of students. The book had a more personal meaning for him as he remembered reading it when he first came to the United States. When I was younger, a teacher shared it with me when I first came to America, he said. Manankamba appreciated that he had come full circle with the book, now reading it to kindergarten students. I read it to learn English, and now I get to read it to kids. That's really cool, he said. At the completion of the day, the literature students wrote reflections on their experience. The whole experience was to meet the objective of reading and sharing a children's book to a class, said Halter. They've been learning all the different genres and age ranges of children's literature and how to apply that here. On page 2, we find an article entitled Johnson's. The article is entitled Democrats Say They Will Save Speaker Mike Johnson's Job If Republicans Try to Oust Him. House Democrats will vote to save Republican Speaker Mike Johnson's job should some of his fellow Republican lawmakers seek to remove him from the position. Democratic leaders said Tuesday, likely assuring for now that Johnson will avoid being ousted from office like his predecessor, former Representative Kevin McCarthy. Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana, has come under heavy criticism from some Republicans for moving forward with aid for Ukraine as part of a $95 billion emergency spending package that passed this month. It would take only a handful of Republicans to remove Johnson from the speakership if the Democratic caucus went along with the effort. But Democratic leaders took that possibility off the table. At this moment, upon completion of our national security work, the time has come to turn the page on this chapter of pro-Putin Republican obstruction, said a statement from the top three House Democrats, Representatives Hakeem Jeffries, Catherine Clark, and Pete Aguilar. We will vote to table Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate the chair. If she revokes the motion, it will not succeed. If she invokes the motion, it will not succeed. The announcement from Democrats ensures that Johnson will survive the most difficult stretch of his tenure so far, which saw him struggle through internal GOP divisions to pass government funding, the renewal of a key surveillance program, and aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. To do so, Johnson was often forced to rely on votes from Democrats, creating an unusual governing coalition that has angered hard-right members who say their majority is being squandered. And that does it for today's reading of The Messenger for May 1, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.